All right, remember, the machine knows if you're lying. First statement, Carvana will give you a real offer on your car all online.
False.
True, actually. You can sell your car in minutes.
False? That's gotta be...
True again. Carvana will pick up your car from your door, or you can drop it off at one of their car vending machines.
Sounds too good to be true, so true.
Finally caught on. Nice job. Honesty isn't just their policy, it's their entire model. Sell your car today, too.
Carvana.
Pickup fees may apply.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome back to the Bonfire Podcast, where we talk about the UFC and mixed martial arts with those closest to the fight game. I am your host, MMA Junkie senior reporter and longtime MMA journalist Mike Bon. I hope everyone is doing well. Being a crazy January so far, coming off of UFC 311, where I was in Los Angeles. What an event, especially that main card on pay-per-view, delivering, I think, in almost every way possible. We got the chaos leading in. Armin Sarukian falls out on weigh-in day. Hanato Moicano steps in against Islam Makhachev, suffers a first-round submission loss, but man, what a week. We have been to so many of these events before. There's always the backup fighter, the standby, but I can't recall too many instances of this type of change happening on such short notice. Credit to Moicano for stepping up, but Islam Makhachev proving once again that he is just too good at lightweight right now. And that is going to lead into a great show that we have here today for you all. Alan Joban going to be joining, and we are going to rank the best lightweight champions of all time coming off of Makhachev's win. Is he now the GOAT at 155 among champions? Alan and I will break that down, give our top 10 lists among the 12 champions undisputed in divisional history, and that will lead into a chat about Islam Makhachev and his greatness. What could potentially be next? Could he go to 185 and fight Dricus du Plessis or the middleweight champion, maybe Sean Strickland if that's him, maybe Khamzat Chimaev down the line, who knows? But Islam throwing out there definitely created a big stir with him saying he would accept a 185 title fight, skip over welterweight and do that right now. Crazy stuff, and definitely a good time to catch up with Alan and get his thoughts on all that. So we will take a quick break. Be sure to stick around till the end of the show. We are going to do a giveaway on the Bonfire for the first time, so you'll want to stick around and see the goods that we have for you guys. So before we do that, though, we will get into our chat with Alan. Please make sure to give the show a thumbs up, a subscription, a like, a comment, whatever you can do to show your support. It means a lot, especially over there on YouTube as we make the drive towards 1,000 subscribers. Appreciate everyone who is following along so far and showing their support. We'll be back on the other side of a quick break with Alan Joban. We are back here on the Bonfire with a first-time guest of the podcast. It is UFC analyst, LFA commentator, SiriusXM host, Mr. Alan Joban. Alan, did I miss any of your titles there?
No, I like that, man. I've never heard them. All of them played out like that, so it sounded good. No, it's good to be on with you, man. I know we've kind of, brushed shoulders back and forth over the years, but I've never been on your show. So I'm happy to be on, man.
Yeah, and it's we're only a few months in, so I haven't held you off here for too long. You're on my list of guests I wanted to be on here, so I appreciate it.
Okay, well, that makes sense then. Only a few months in, so I don't feel so bad.
Yeah, awesome. How are you? I mean, we're in an off week for the UFC here. I know the MMA doesn't stop kind of around the globe, but I know you're kind of always on the desk and very involved in the sport. So what do you kind of do for a UFC off week when there's no flying to Vegas or anything?
Yeah, it's been, I mean, obviously the holidays that we all dealt with when there were 4 weeks with no fighting, it was an odd time. But, you know, it's the holidays, you're doing your holiday things, you're doing your family thing, but you're missing the fights. And so far, it's been pretty amazing. The fight night that we had delivered, the pay-per-view that we had delivered, two fights in, two cards in, and we're off to a pretty damn good start. I know this has been like a topic of conversation with like the broadcast deal coming up with the UFC, but it just feels like in my opinion, that things are really building. The fights are delivering early on, but just everything that's been happening with the UFC and the momentum that they have, the Netflix deal last year with Tyson, and then WWE going to them. It's just like you just feel like they're going to be a major player. The UFC has been delivering. It's an exciting year. I just feel like there's a lot of big changes are going to come in the next year or so.
Yeah, for sure. I think the UFC's exclusive negotiation window with ESPN starts like right now, and we'll go for the next few months. We'll see what happens. And then, of course, yeah, we're going to get some big announcements toward the back end of the year. But we were speaking off camera. I know, you know, this is kind of the off week, but sounds like you have some travel going up. You're going working the desk for Saudi for the first event of February. Have you made that trip over there for a card yet?
I've never been, so I'm excited to go. Never been to Saudi Arabia, and I don't believe I've ever been a part of a Israel Adesanya fight. So that has me really excited. I feel like Izzy's one of those guys that for a while I was saying that when the UFC needed more stars, right? When the Conor McGregors weren't fighting, Israel Adesanya was that guy to me. I mean, when you look at his social media, his following, and just the way that he does, he has like an Ilia Topuria type of swagger, right? Where he doesn't do it. He's not going to wear the Reebok kit to the weigh-in, right? He's not going to jump in the van to come to the show. He does everything very big, and he plays up the dramatics. And I love that about him. You know, he's a performer. He's a dancer. Like, he literally is a performer. But he also performs in the fight game, and he's also one of the most skilled technical fighters that we've ever had step foot inside of the octagon. So he's a guy that just has me very excited to be a part of one of his fight weeks and kind of see where does he go from here, right? Mm-hmm. Is he a guy that just kind of starts to get lost in the shuffle as a former champion? Or is he a guy that kind of emerges as someone that fights his way back to the title shot again?
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like, this matchup, definitely a defining one of his career against Nassourdine Imavov, just to show, as you kind of laid out, is he still that guy? But they could have given this fight to anyone, right? Like, Caio Baralho wanted it. A bunch of these dudes on the rise. Did you think Imavov, given what he's done, you know, over the past couple of years, some big wins, was he the best candidate for this fight with Israel, you think?
I think so. I think so. He's somebody that, I don't want to say the word like emerging, because he's always been that guy. But I believe his last win was over Brandon Allen, right? And Brandon Allen is, people really couldn't figure him out, right? He was the guy taking down grapplers and submitting them. He was the guy that was just making all the right decisions. And Imavov found a way to make Brandon Allen make very bad decisions in that fight, taking shots from out of range, didn't feel comfortable in the pocket at all. And that's what he brings to the table. So it'll be interesting to see how much Imavov is able to can he make Israel Adesanya uncomfortable? Can he make him make those mistakes? Can he exploit Israel Adesanya like everybody thought they would do in the beginning of Izzy's career, take him to the ground? And nobody really was able to do that until Dricus du Plessis was able to start taking him down and exploiting those holes in the grappling. It's a very interesting fight. I think Imavov is a guy that is one of the more well-rounded technical fighters in the division fighting at the top. It's an exciting one, man. Like I said, Imavov's a guy that has always impressed me, and Izzy's a guy that I've always been a fan of, and it's a fantastic... You know, when they go to Saudi Arabia, right, they have to deliver. You can't go there with a crap card. You can't go there and have some has-beens in the main event, and they stack this card up pretty good. You look at that fight, you look at the co-main event with MVP going up in weight to fight Cheryl Bullitt. I mean, that's a spectacular fight. That should be fireworks in that one, and it's kind of got me puzzled, that co-main event. I know I'm switching gears on you, but Charles Bullitt, he's the man. He's very good. He's the man on the feet, right? I think we still get to see some of his ground game, but MVP is a guy that makes everybody look not as good when they stand with him. You saw what happened with Ian Machado Gary when he tried to stand. All of a sudden, he became a grappler. Can he do that going up a weight class, though? That's what's the most intriguing thing for me. MVP is very good at controlling the range, but now he's going up against a bigger fighter who's very good at the in and out kind of Russian Russian style of striking, almost like in boxing. Beevil, you watch Beevil box, it's a very in and out pocket style. And that's what Charles Bullitt brings. But will he be able to do that against the bladed stance, the fast movement? They'll be able to, the ability to close the distance with that laser right hand like MVP does. So I'm already, this is the first time I've talked about these fights because I haven't studied it yet, but that's the homework. That's the research that I have to kind of go over and analyze before these fights. And I'm still scratching my head about both of these matchups.
Yeah, well, you'll have plenty of time to look it over on that long flight to Saudi Arabia. Oh, yeah. I've done that a few times. But yeah, what a big month for the middleweight division. Obviously, those two fights. The next week, obviously, the championship fight between Du Plessis and Strickland. And then I think a couple weeks after that, a man you referenced there and Brendan Allen fighting Fluffy Hernandez in Seattle. So is going to be a pretty big month for the middleweight division in February. But obviously, as I said off the intro, Alan, the reason I have you on today is to talk about the lightweight division on the back end of UFC 311. Islam Makhachev in the main event sets the lightweight title defense record. With a first-round submission of Renato Moicano. I think all the chaos and everything of what happened in LA has kind of been talked about. Pretty nuts that we got that change on a little over 24 hours' notice, but Islam doing what he had to do and kind of stamping his legacy with that title defense record. And I think that parlayed perfectly into a debate. Who is the lightweight GOAT? Where does he rank among the all-time lightweight champions? And that was the bit of homework I gave you to do for the show today. We are going to give our top 10 lightweight champions of all time. And we're going to start, I guess, at the bottom and count up to the top here and see how our lists compare here. So, Alan, did you find this assignment difficult, or what was your kind of thoughts on as you assembled your list?
Here's the thing about this list, Mike. It's going to be very debatable for a lot of people. But I feel like the first top three names, the number one, two, and three top lightweight champions of all time are somewhat easy. They could be somewhat of a shuffled order, but I feel like we're going to be pretty agreeable in some of these names. It's when you get to the bottom of the list, some of the older names, some of the former champions that our new fans aren't even that familiar with. They probably haven't even seen their body of work or remember them or know that they weren't even watching the sport until after the Conor McGregor era, right? Where they're not going to be as familiar with the BJ Penns, et cetera, guys like that. And it becomes very shuffled to me, not only when you look at the title defenses, but what was the competition like in that era? And that's when it... And then it becomes MMA math. Like, okay, this guy was good, but then he got beat by this guy. But the guy that beat him didn't do as many title defenses. So I think the last three quarters of our list, which we're going to start with first, I think these are going to be all over the place.
For sure. And I guess just for the viewers here, there is being 12 undisputed lightweight champions in UFC history. We're going to name our top 10. So 12-2 will be left off the list, but I will just read the names here in chronological order of who the lightweight champions were, just to give people an idea. And they've been Jens Pulver, Sean Sherk, BJ Penn, Frankie Edgar, Benson Henderson, Anthony Pettis, Rafael Dos Anjos, Eddie Alvarez, Conor McGregor, Khabib Nurmagomedov, Charles Oliveira, and Islam Makhachev. So I will give you the floor first, Alan. Who did you have at number 10 on your list?
This was a tough one because I didn't want to leave any of these guys out or show any disrespect. But when I look at this list, I also have to combine, as I mentioned, not only what they have done, but if these guys were to face one another at some point in their career, who do I think would have won? Who was facing the tougher competition when they were the champion? And if I had to take each of these fighters at their prime, who do I think would have won? And so with that said, number 10 on my list is going to be Eddie Alvarez. I think Eddie Alvarez is a guy that, although he had zero title defenses, if I did my homework correctly, he had zero title defenses. When he won the belt, he did a guy, I fought on the same card as him in Las Vegas. That was back in the day when we used to do Thursday, Friday, Saturday fights at International Fight Week. And this was a Thursday fight. And he dethroned RDA that night, and RDA was just killing it. I mean, it was just a cardio machine. We couldn't really find a weakness in the armor. And Eddie Alvarez is a guy that came in and was not only able to do that, but when I look at some of the wins on the list, I mean, Eddie Alvarez is another guy that was known as a violent fighter, fought the best of the best. And he did that very well, had a short reign as champion, but I have to give him his credit for what he has done and put him at number 10 on my list.
Yeah, I think that's a solid one. I left Eddie slightly off. He was my 11, so he, I guess, was just on the cutoff. But I think you made a great point there. I mean, his beating RDA the way he did, I mean, the guy was also a Bellator lightweight champion, so he's got kind of that two organization status. I think the first fighter to win titles in UFC and Bellator, so that was huge for his legacy as well. And of course, a great mention as we go into BKFC Knucklemania this weekend, where he's fighting Jeremy Stephens. The guy's still doing it all these years later, still one of the most violent in the game. So I like that choice, and I think
even if he is slightly left off my list, he's still one of the biggest winners in the fact that he got to headline a pay-per-view against Conor McGregor as champion and got the points. So that was probably a payday that he is still living off to this point. So yeah, Eddie Alvarez, great choice, a legend of the game. For my number 10, I had Sean Sherk. I just had him right in the tail end there. Obviously, one of the early lightweight champions, you know, we talk about this division. The UFC tried to get rid of this thing a few times in the early days. Like, you know, people talk about how they tried to remove the flyweight division, right? Like more recently, this they did that to lightweight years and years prior.
The lightweight was the flyweight division.
Yeah,
back in
exactly.
The day.
And, you know, Sean Sherk was a guy who helped bring that back, you know, beat Kenny Florian, Hermes Franca. You know, you could make a lot of things about his resume, the fact that he was stripped because of a failed drug test and stuff. But, you know, that was kind of the game back then too. So I have him at 10 and yeah, respect to Sean Sherk. Any thoughts on Sean Sherk?
He was a great champion. I think some of the things that you just mentioned is why I left him off my list. You know, we didn't know how much he was taking substances at that time. I think a lot of guys were doing things back in the day. So it wasn't just him alone, but failed drug test. It showed. I mean, you look at the guy just had veins popping out of him everywhere, so he didn't really know much of a clean.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Fighter, how legit this win was. Yeah. And I think, you know, slightly level of competition. You know, I think just the sport has evolved so much that it was still kind of new back in the day. And he was the big, strong guy that had kind of figured out the way to get the wins, but the competition hadn't quite caught up with him at the time.
Yeah, totally fair. Okay, I'll stick on this and I'll go with my 9. I had RDA, who you referenced there, Rafael Dos Anjos, who did just have a kind of a walk in the park, but he was able to defend it against Donald Cerrone. I think it was like a 71-second TKO down there in Florida somewhere. But yeah, he had a bit of a tricky reign there, right? I think the weight cutting had a big influence on that fight with Eddie Alvarez and maybe his chin where he lost the title. But yeah, RDA was, you know, a great, and what he did to Anthony Pettis to take that title was an epic performance at the time. I think he went 50-44'd him in one of those scorecards way back then. So yeah, I have him at my number 9. What about you? Who's your 9?
I feel like before I get to it, I feel like RDA, yeah. Did he fight Donald Cerrone? Wasn't it in Colorado, or am I wrong? I feel like because I remember that fight. I remember a fight with Cowboy Cerrone and Cowboy's corner saying, "You're not going to do this. Don't do this here. You can't do this in front of your fans in Denver, in front of your, you know, your hometown crowd." And I thought that had something to do with it before he ate that liver kitten.
That was that was in Orlando, the fight. Maybe you're thinking of the one with Masvidal. I think that was in Denver. I'm not sure.
You're right. You're right.
Cerrone had so many damn fights.
I knew I shouldn't have argued it because that's not my strength. Remembering the time and the place, that's never it. Solid choice. RDA was a machine. I mean, when RDA was firing, God, it's like he was kind of the Benson Henderson. Like, this guy has an unlimited gas tank. He's a black belt in jiu-jitsu. He has good grappling, and he has knockout power. Mm-hmm. And that was the puzzle that people were trying to figure out. But I think I'm going to get some shit on this one because this guy is a legend. This guy is a legend. And a lot of our newcomers don't really know how good he was back in the day. But I got to go BJ Penn, number 9 on my list. And I know that seems low because BJ Penn had 3 title defenses. BJ Penn was also, I believe, a double champ, not at the same time, but he also went up to the welterweight division, had a lot of success, had wins over guys like Matt Hughes, fought the who's who, the Nick Diaz's, everyone. I guess what drops him on my list is, and I try not to look at this when it comes to fighters, Mike, but I cannot avoid it when it comes to BJ Penn, is when they fight too long. Mm-hmm. He reigned very supreme when he was the champion, but he ended his career in a very lackluster way. And it's hard to forget that when guys go on 6 or 7 fight losing streaks, when guys get in trouble over and over. I mean, they're getting in bar fights. He was losing bar fights at that point in his career.
It
was very bad. And he just started looking like just not even a glimpse of the original guy. He changed his style. He lost his striking. He couldn't take people down. The jiu-jitsu was irrelevant anymore. I've said enough bad things about him. Let me talk about the good things. Three title defenses, two weight classes. He was one of the most competitive guys, and he had this natural ability. That's what I love about BJ. Before we knew Max Holloway, it was BJ Penn that represented Hawaii. When you think about Hawaii and UFC, it was BJ Penn. He was the most beloved fighter. Everybody just loved the guy. I remember him talking about when Tim Sylvia was the heavyweight champion. He goes, I want to fight that guy. And we were like, what are you talking about? How are you going to fight a heavyweight who's 6'8" or something like that? He goes, man, I might get his back. I might choke him out, bro. Like, you don't know what could happen. BJ was crazy, and we loved the craziness about him. So BJ Penn gets number 9 on my list.
Okay. Yeah. A lot to unpack there. I had him a fair bit higher, but I think your reasoning there is completely valid. Yeah. You mentioned the Tim Sylvia stuff. I mean, there is footage of him fighting Lyoto Machida at heavyweight out there. Like, that's how insane this guy was. And yeah, I mean, obviously had his stuff at welterweight, fought later at featherweight, but man, when he was in his prime at lightweight, like, there was no one like this guy. His performances against Shirk, against Florian, against Joe Stevenson to win the title, the Diego Sanchez performance was just unreal. Yeah. But it almost seemed like this dude got bored fighting at 55, and you know, the second GSP fight where he went back up right in the middle of that reign and took a pretty brutal loss, I think was something that, you know, he never fully recovered from. He looked great when he came back to lightweight again and managed to defend that title, I think, once more after that. But yeah, I mean, you just, so many what ifs with BJ Penn. He might be one of the biggest what ifs ever. If he had stuck to his discipline, stuck to the right weight class, I imagine he could be sitting here like talking about him as the first or second, and probably much more title defenses under his belt. So
at one point we were talking about him as a GOAT, Mike, like, I mean, back in the day. And I think part of the reason, not only that I put him low on my list, because I should really just be able to look past what happened later in his career and it's look at only though. When he was in his prime, but it was also level of competition back in the day. BJ Penn was ahead of the game. He was amazing. Mm-hmm. But the Sean Shirks, the Diego Sanchez's, to me, they weren't quite the guys that they're fighting today. And that's why I dropped them a little bit lower on my list. You want me to keep going?
From there. Yeah.
So I'll go number 8. Part of the reason it starts kind of becoming a mathematical equation at this point, because any of these could flip flop. But one of the guys I believe that took the belt from BJ Penn was Frankie Edgar. Right. Mm-hmm. And so you look at Frankie Edgar, the choo-choo train that kept on going, the smaller guy. He was always a smaller guy in there, and he would always find a way to do it. And when I think of people who were able to blend in the beautiful wrestling to the boxing back and forth, I think none other did it better than Frankie Edgar. And another guy that I would just throw a name in a hat that blended that style together very well was Rashad Evans is a guy that knew how to punch to the takedown, and I've felt that before. I've trained with him, but never trained with Frankie Edgar, but those two guys were able to do it so seamlessly. So Frankie Edgar, another guy that has three title defenses. He has a win over BJ Penn, who was number 9 on my list. And that is why I give Frankie Edgar number 8 on my all-time list.
Very interesting. I'm now super fascinated to see what the top of your list looks like, Alan, because again, another person I had quite a bit higher than you and Frankie, but again, sound reasoning. He did have the three title defenses, one of them a little bit of an asterisk because it was a draw, but you still get it towards your title defense count because you do not lose the belt in that regard. But yeah, I mean, dude, the fact that this guy was fighting at 55 when we saw him end his career at 35 and all the years at 45, like, I think he gets extra bonus points for me for doing what he did as such an undersized fighter. But yeah, like, at the time when he took the title from BJ at UFC 118, I mean, one of the biggest upsets, shocking results at the time, just because, as we spoke so highly about BJ, he seemed to be unbeatable at that point. And Frankie Edgar went in there and boxed him up and, you know, did it again in a rematch, and then gave us those epic wars with Gray Maynard. And yeah, just such an unbelievable run. And then, you know, you can make a lot of, as I'm sure we'll talk about later with Benson Henderson, a lot of thoughts about whether he rightfully lost the title in that very close fight they had in Japan too. So yeah, Frankie, one of the all-time greats there. And yeah, man, like, what a legend of the sport, UFC Hall of Famer now. We are loving Frankie Edgar over here, but I will parlay this into my number 8. And I had Charles Oliveira at number 8.
What?
Yeah. I mean, you might want him
number
a little
8.
Yeah, I mean,
that's low, think, Mike. Charles Oliveira.
So I'll give you my reasoning. My, I mean, of course, his body of work at lightweight is insane, but this is a guy who lost his title on the scale because he couldn't make weight. And to me, that hurts your standing a little bit. I mean, we know, like, the title defense he got. We love Dustin Poirier over here. I know your buddy, like Louisiana guy, Dustin's always been great to me. So I value that win extremely high. His title winning performance too was huge. But yeah, man, like I got to drop you down a little bit if you're losing the belt on the scale.
I'm kind of shocked, Mike. I feel it's like just, this was to me a no. He was a shoe in to me, like in that elite, that top three, four, five guy. Oh my God, Charles Oliveira.
Well,
Charles
I think maybe
put Charles Oliveira against some of the guys we're naming. I just oh my, we're gonna go back and forth on this, man, because you look at title defenses, you look at the era that they fought, you look at the competition that they fought, and then to me, you gotta have to almost say, take this guy in his prime and take this guy in his prime, and what was the outcome? And that's why I have. My go ahead, man. I'm still in your time right now. You're still arguing your point, but no, my goodness, Charles Oliveira.
I like that we have kind of the conflicting stances here. Again, I think that's just his big thing. If you had a second title defense on here against Justin Gaethje with what he did and the way he looked in that fight, it was unbelievable, but it wasn't a title fight for him. And that's like, that hurt him a lot.
Oh. So you wait, know? Charles Oliveira had how many title defenses? Two?
He just had the one against Dustin, like won the belt against Chandler and then defended but when against he beat, Dustin. And
when
then
he beat Justin Gaethje, it wasn't considered a title defense.
Because he missed weight and
because
lost
he lost the belt. To the scale. But he still beat him. Oh my
I know,
gosh.
But it wasn't a title fight for him. So if we are ranking the greatest lightweights ever, I think Charles Oliveira is much higher on my list. If we're just talking about kind of championship stuff, this is where I drop him. So interesting, though. Definitely a big conflict between us on that one. So I'll go into my number seven then to see if yours matches up there. I went with Anthony Pettis at seven, which... Again, you know, small amount of title defenses. You said this off the top that this area in the rankings was going to be a little bit tricky for us, right? But I rate his title winning performance quite highly. I rank his title defense against Gilbert Melendez, who was, you know, obviously one of the best lightweights in the world at that time, Strikeforce champion. A lot of people feel he was robbed in his first title shot against Benson Henderson. And for Pettis to go in there and submit him the way he did was extremely impressive. We know the way he won the title too against Benson in their rematch in Milwaukee. So, yeah, I mean, Showtime, I know he didn't have a long run with the belt, but at that time in those two performances, you were like, this guy is so well-rounded, the striking, he could submit you off your back. Like, he was extremely dangerous. So that's why I had Anthony Pettis at seven. Do you align with that? What did your seven look like?
I'm close with the Pettis on that one. We're in the same ballpark on this one, but obviously when we change him up early, there's going to be change ups in the middle, and this is somewhere in the middle. Number seven for me, I'm going to give this to Benson Henderson. Benson Henderson is another one of these guys that had three title defenses. And him and RDA had this thing where I didn't know how anyone would beat them. They seemed like cardio machines. They could grapple. They could strike. They could submit you. They all had like a specialty. Like Benson Henderson had a really good guillotine. He had this unbelievable gas tank. And do you remember the era of the toothpick? Like the toothpick. Yes, he would fight for five rounds and he would get done and he would pull a toothpick out of his mouth guard. And they were like, Joe Rogan would be like, did you have that in there the whole time? And he would kind of like, you know, play to it because the commission wouldn't like that.
Yeah.
I think he proposed to his wife after one of these titles fights well, got engaged to his wife in the middle of the octagon. Benson was this thing at the time where I just remember thinking, how do you beat someone if they don't get tired? To me, cardio has always been a superpower, because if you could fight at 100% and never have to recover, have recovery time during a fight, you're going to dominate people. And he had that when he was in his prime. Three title defenses. And again, I'm kind of trickling up the list, but when you look at the 9, 8, and 7 fighters that I mentioned, BJ Penn, Frankie Yeager, Benson Henderson, that's kind of the order that they all beat each other. It was BJ Penn, Frankie Yeager took it from BJ Penn, and then Benson Henderson dethroned Frankie Edgar, I believe, and then went on a run. And so that is the reasoning behind the man, Benson Henderson, number seven.
Yeah, I have him a little bit higher too, but I think that's a good range for Benson. I think the only thing that maybe you could say hurts his status a little bit is there was a lot of controversial decisions in his reign, right? Like, he won the belt fairly controversially against Frankie. The defense was somewhat controversial. The Gilbert Melendez fight was very controversial, but the Nate Diaz title defense, he no controversy there. He beat him up bad. That was a main event on Fox. You know, he's having Nate Diaz flip him off in the middle of the fight and stuff like that. So yeah, I mean, when I almost felt like when you were talking about his cardio and everything, I'm like, are you describing Merab Dvalishvili in a little way? It's like there's almost some layovers there. And yeah, he was one of those guys that weaponized cardio to an extremely strong point. So yeah, I think that's a great choice with Benson Henderson. Here, give me a back-to-back, Alan. Who's your six?
Okay, so you named them already, man. Number six is Anthony Pettis. Showtime. I mean, the guy, when he did the Showtime kick in the WEC off the cage, it was, I don't think I watched it live, and I woke up the next morning and I saw a picture of it. And I just remember scratching my head thinking, how does any human being get that much height? How do they get that much height on a kick? And then when I went back and watched it, I go, holy shit. Wow. Did I just not uncover this the whole time that I've been playing around in an octagon? How did he figure this out? And he did that kick against my number seven guy, Benson Henderson. He then went on to the UFC, lost his first fight against Clay Guida, I believe, got it, trying to be a little too spectacular too early in his career, but found his rhythm, found his style of fighting against that level of competition in the UFC, got back to the title picture and beat Benson Henderson again. He looked phenomenal. Anthony Pettis, one of the most versatile strikers we have ever seen inside the octagon at the 155 division, and a really underrated jiu-jitsu artist. Very, very good in the grappling game. Very good submissions. To my point, was able to submit Benson Henderson, take the belt from him with an armbar. That's why Anthony Pettis is ahead of Benson Henderson at number six on my list.
Yeah, great choice there. I fondly remember the Showtime kick, watching it live. I was I think I was still in high school at that point, and I was watching the fights with my girlfriend at the time, sitting on my lap, and he did that kick off the cage and I literally jumped off the couch and she went flying to the floor. But that was my degree of excitement there, because we've never seen anything like that. It's I think maybe one of the misremembered highlights in MMA history. People think that was a knockout shot, but it was not. It was just a knockdown. But
I was trying to remember what happened. Did he finish
it? Sealed the fight for him though on the scorecards, and made it definitive in his favor. So great choice. Okay, we are going to get into the top.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Top five here now. I need to give six on my list. Number six on my list was Jens Pulver. Who is, of course, one of the OGs, UFC Hall of Famer, the first ever inaugural UFC lightweight champion. So he defended that thing twice. Obviously, you can point to the era, very early inception of MMA, as you kind of said throughout this. The talent wasn't nearly what it was today, but I think you always need to shout out the OGs. I'm glad he got his Hall of Fame respect finally in recent years. And yeah, I mean, one of the guys there, but I guess if you were to take some credit away, like, he wasn't able to sustain that division, as we talked about. UFC tried to get rid of it at that time, so I think that hurts him a little bit, but it's one of the OGs of the sport, so he has to be, I think, on the upper side of my list. So I had Jens at six.
All the respect in the world to Jens Pulver, and it was such a beautiful moment when they announced his Hall of Fame status. I mean, to see that live and to see him tearing up, I believe it was with his son. It was a beautiful moment. Love seeing that for legends in the sport. But the reason I left him off my list is just because of the time. As you mentioned, the division at that time was not thriving. They needed stars. They needed guys that were doing things like Anthony Pettis jumping off the cage. And Jens wasn't doing that. And then again, I look at just the level of competition back in the day. Because for me, it's like when somebody says they have Hoist Gracie, and I'm not making this exact comparison, but if you say Hoist Gracie is in my GOAT, I'm like, look, he did phenomenal things, but he's not a GOAT. He was somebody that had something before other people had it and realized that, and he was able to exploit that, and he was incredible. He should be on some type of Mount Rushmore in terms of what he brought to the sport, but not in level of competition. Hoist Gracie wouldn't stand a chance against this modern day age. And I'm not making that exact comparison, but I think that with Jens Pulver, I think the level of competition just wasn't quite there yet when you look at the guys like the Pettises and the Benson Henderson that evolved after that time.
Fascinating. So who was your number five then? If I'm intrigued that Jens wasn't in there. So who'd you have at five?
Again, Jens, like I said, it was just too old school for me. Although I was watching at the time, it was still, we're still figuring out this sport, man. Figuring out what works. That was the long board short days when guys were just like throwing punches and shooting takedowns in the open. And so number five on my list is the guy that you mentioned already, Mike, RDA. RDA is a guy that he had the same thing as Benson Henderson. He was this cardio machine, high level jiu-jitsu black belt. If he could out grapple you, he would out grapple you and submit you. If he couldn't do that, he would find a way to hurt you on the feet. That southpaw style, the way that he was able to hurt Cowboy Cerrone that we mentioned. And I believe he is the guy that also took the belt from Anthony Pettis, who was my number six. So that's part of the reason. Again, it's hard to do MMA math. You're going to look at these, at least my bottom 4 to 10, and it's almost who took the belt from that person, mm-hmm. right? And that the reason that I did that is because although some guys had 3 title defenses, some guys had 2 title defenses, it's hard to really figure out who should be ahead of that person. But I take, so I say, how do I dispute that? Just like a fight that's very close on the feet, you say, okay, well, who is the aggressor, right? Who had more cage control? And when I look at these, the way that I decipher it, I say, well, who won when they faced each other in their prime? And RDA was able to beat Anthony Pettis, who was my number six guy. And that's why RDA comes in at number 5 on my list.
I like that. That's you're very thoughtful about this, Alan. So I appreciate this. And I think you're doing a great job here. My number 5 was Benson Henderson, who we addressed. Don't think we need to add too much more to that. My number 4 was BJ Penn. That's where I put him a little bit higher. Just again, those title defenses, how amazing he was in his prime, just such an unstoppable force. So that's why I had him there. Who was your number 4 then?
I'm smiling already, Mike. It's about to get real interesting right here.
Yeah.
Okay. Number 4 on my list is a name that you cannot mention when you mention this sport. Cannot help but mention, that's Conor McGregor. Although Conor McGregor had 0 title defenses.
Yeah.
Name a bigger star in the sport. I don't need to go over Conor's accolades. We know, but he was a double champ. Conor was a champion at 45. He went up to 155. And the guy that I just spoke about a couple fights ago, it was in the beginning of my list, but Eddie Alvarez. Mm-hmm. Eddie Alvarez was one of the most violent fighters. We spoke about what he has done. Eddie Alvarez is a guy that has wins over a lot of the top guys in the division. The way that Conor McGregor was able to go through Eddie Alvarez and have that highlight reel, step back, left hand, finishing combo. I mean, it was just such a thing of beauty. And when Conor McGregor had that fight, I truly believe he was the best guy in the world. Well, now we kind of look at it and say, Conor's not quite that good, as good as we thought he was. But when he was fighting at that time, he had a timing with his striking that people couldn't figure out. He had the most power in the division. Everybody that had been hit by him says, I've never been hit by anybody that hard. Mm-hmm. He had underrated ground game. He is a black belt today, but back in the day, he was still a guy. He came into 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu one time, and I remember Eddie Bravo just could not stop talking about how good and underrated his ground skills were. We just didn't see it because he was fighting guys like Khabib and everything, and he was so dominant on the feet. But for what he did in the sport, Conor McGregor, the guy that changed the game, the guy that brings the most money, the most pay-per-views, the most anything on a stat, that's Conor McGregor. And although he was a champion at 45, and today he fights at 70 or maybe even 85, when I think of Conor McGregor, I think of 55. I don't think of any other division. He was one of those guys at 55 that was calling out the big guns. And he was supposed to fight, you know, other people. Some fights didn't happen. But the way that he was able to run through some of these champions and former champions, it just it was so impressive. So I feel like Conor McGregor has to be on this list despite all the up and downs. Mm-hmm. Here's where it gets tricky, Mike. I'm about to hand it to you, but I've got an honorable mention at number 4. I could not do this list without naming my guy Dustin Poirier on this. And I know he was never the undisputed champion, but yep, he was an interim champion. He does have a belt on his mantle at his house. And here's my case for Dustin Poirier. Name one fighter who has a stronger resume than Dustin Poirier. The only guy I could think of that would be close to it in that weight division or around that weight division, RDA. Some of the guys, because he had fought at 2 weight classes, 170, 155. But a pure 155, Dustin Poirier has fought the who's who, the toughest guys on that list. And guys on this list, Eddie Alvarez, champion. Dustin Poirier beat him twice, right? Didn't he have a
no contest. And then,
a no contest that Dustin was
in the second one.
Yeah, yeah, and then he went and finished him in the second one. Anthony Pettis finished him. Conor McGregor finished him twice. Mm-hmm. Then he also fought Khabib, Islam, Charles Oliveira. Dustin Poirier has fought the toughest tests. He is the most violent fighter in the UFC. He does have an interim champ, and he's got wins over guys on this list when they were in their prime. So that's why I give Dustin Poirier the honorable mention at number 4.
For sure. I love that. I think one of the great injustices that's been done in recent years was the fact that the second fight between Dustin and Connor in Abu Dhabi on Fight Island was not for the title. The UFC and Dana White were so desperate to hold on to Khabib as the champion and try to get him back. They didn't, you know, acknowledge him saying, I'm done. This title is essentially vacant. That should have been a lightweight title fight, and that should have been the night Dustin became the undisputed lightweight champion. It's BS that it didn't happen, but it is what it is. So I think we can slide him in there too on that footnote. I think that's a great one. Again, if we're making a lightweight GOAT like list just based on, like, you know, not the champions, just the all-time lightweight fighters, Dustin is easily top three in my opinion. So I like that you slid him in there. As far as Connor, I didn't have him on my list.
I had
him right on the outside. Now that I'm kind of looking it back over, maybe I would have put him at 10 and knocked off Sean Sherk. But man, what you said there, like his performance against Eddie Alvarez, arguably the greatest UFC championship performance that we've ever seen. It was absolutely insane. He was on fire that night. He could not be hit. He could not miss. The highlights of those, what you mentioned, him slipping, landing the counters, that's going to be on the highlight reels forever. And that was the pinnacle moment, of course, of Conor McGregor's career, becoming the double champ. And, you know, that put him on the road to boxing Floyd Mayweather. And we all know what's happened in the years since then. He's never been able to recapture that magic in mixed martial arts. But yeah, I don't object given the name, given that one performance alone. I think that's a fine place to put Connor. So very interesting on your behalf. For my number four, I don't know if I mentioned him, BJ Penn. Yeah, so you, I went into that for you. So, okay, we'll go back to you, Alan, as we get into the top three here. Who kicks off your top three here?
All right, the guy that you gave no love to, Mike. I'm going to give him the love he so much deserved. Du Bronx, baby. Okay. Du Bronx, Charles Oliveira. What can I say about this guy? He's beloved. We love him. I mean, he's got those perfect teeth. He's got those sharp-edged lines on his face. You look at the most submissions in UFC history, the finishing ability on the feet. When Charles is on, I really think he's one of the best in the world. The problem with Charles, why he didn't get a little bit higher, I mean, obviously he didn't have as many title defenses. I had him in at two title defenses. You corrected me earlier in the show that one of them didn't make weight. So one of them didn't count. So it was only one title defense, but he still fought the guy that he was supposed to fight and won and win. So I kind of have him at two title defenses, but he was just so good. He's so good. Charles Oliveira, when he is on, is one of the best in the world. It's just, we never knew if he was going to be on or off. He would have off nights when he fought Islam. I don't like the way he came out and did a flying knee and got caught with the check hook. It just didn't make a lot of sense. He had losses to other guys where he wasn't that same guy. Like, we questioned his heart. We questioned, does he want to be in there if he becomes the nail, not the hammer? He changed something throughout his career and found a way to get through that adversity, getting hurt by Michael Chandler, getting hurt by other fighters and coming back. And once he changed that mindset, I'm like, this guy has more technique. He's kind of Ilya Topuria-ish, where he's the better striker. He's the better grappler in there, technique-wise. And he's so long, so rangy. He's such a fan favorite. I had to put Charles Oliveira, number three on my list.
Yeah, I dig it. That losing the title on the scale is so rough, and especially because it was in Arizona and they were using a digital scale and he was 0.5 over, and in 90% of other places where they were using a beam scale, it would have been, you know, 155 and we move on. But that commissioner on that day decided to be a stickler and it cost Charles his title. But yeah, I mean, the lightweight performance, you know, if his one title defense is still over Dustin Poirier, who we just alluded to, I mean, that is pretty high value on its own, right? So yeah, I think not an objectionable choice there. Charles can definitely be in your top three, and maybe he can enhance that if he wins the title back. It seems like he might have a chance to rematch Islam sometime this year. So we shall see. My number three was Frankie Edgar, who we talk plenty about. I think, you know, major, major points for being the undersized guy, having those three title defenses, the wars he gave us. Man, if this was a heart of the champion list, he would be at number one, Frankie Edgar. Yeah. Not enough superlatives to describe how special what he did was. And I think we're going to be pretty matched up here on our top two here, Alan. There's only two names left. It's just a question of what order do you have Khabib Nurmagomedov and Islam Makhachev in? I will give you the floor. Who's your number two and by default number one?
Mike, I was pretty sure that both of us would have the same names on our top two lists. When you think about the best fighters we have ever seen, who they have beaten, title defenses, dominance, two names come to mind, Khabib and Islam. And I think it becomes an order that you put them in. And for number two on my list, I'm going to go with Islam Makhachev. Although he just got his fourth win, which would make him the most wins in lightweight history, I did not give it to him above his counterpart, Khabib, because of a couple of reasons. And I'll tell you now. First off, when I look at Khabib, the dominance, right? Such a dominant champion, only lost two rounds in, I think, his entire career. Mm-hmm. Khabib, when you look at 10-8 rounds, I think he had seven 10-8 rounds. 10-8 rounds. I mean, that we know what a 10-8 means. It means dominance, a clear cut. There's no questions asked. He had seven of those rounds throughout his career. And then I look at Islam. I think Islam, if he gets one more win, I would give it to him, no matter who it is. It's, for me, it's got to be Ormond. It's got to be Ormond. I think that's the toughest stylistic matchup for Islam. It might not be. You just said it. It might be Charles Oliveira rematch. I would like to see Ormond. I think that would solidify him as the best we have ever seen. And the finishes. Oh, my goodness. I mean, he's two Darce finishes, the same kind of baby Darce that he does on the forearm. The last two fights, the knockout head kick over Alexander Volkanovski. Submitting Charles Oliveira, the guy who has the most submissions. He is on a tear. The reason I didn't put him at number one, though, is a couple things. Obviously, the first two title defenses were against a 45er. As good as Alexander Volkanovski looked, he was a 45er fighting up. Short notice, too. And so it hurt his rankings with me a tad bit. Then also, I did not love the way that the Poirier fight happened. Yes, I was happy for my friend Dustin to have the opportunity. But that was the fight of anybody who remotely made sense. That was the best stylistic matchup. And that's why they wanted him. Do you remember before Dustin Poirier fought Benoit Saint-Denis? Ali went up to Dustin and said, hey, you win. You want to fight for the title? And they were like, what? What do you mean title? A title fight? I get a title fight? They were looking at Dustin a long ways away. They knew this is the fight that they wanted. This was the fight that stylistically would favor them the most. And so I did not like that they kind of handpicked Dustin, although he was somewhere in the conversation, but I don't think he was the top person in the conversation because it was a favorable matchup for them. So that rubbed me the wrong way a bit in terms of his strength. And then also, when you look at Khabib beat Dustin Poirier when Dustin was in his prime. Islam beat him when Dustin was 35, just turning 36. You know, so I think it was more of a stronger Dustin Poirier that Khabib had in that win right there. But one more win, I think we can't dispute it anymore. But I had Islam at number two. I'm curious to see where you had at number two.
Yeah, I had Khabib at two.
Everything I just said, throw it out the window.
No, but I think you made very good points. I'm now like, did I get this one wrong? I mean, it's so close. Like, again, some of the same names on there, like the Dustin one is obviously their crossover. Khabib against Gaethje, like, he gets a lot of points for a lot of these fights, right? Like, the first title defense against Conor McGregor, the biggest fight and most viewed fight in UFC history. You could say what you want about where Conor was coming into that, but obviously, like, that was a huge moment for him to go win it the way he did. And, you know, the brawl, like, that was just one of the biggest moments in the sport's history, and Khabib was the winning part of that, so a lot of credit there. You mentioned the Dustin fight, the Gaethje fight with such a heavy heart, knowing he was going to retire, like, all that stuff was a lot there. But yeah, I think I just had him at two because, again, like, it's hard for me to knock the guy who has the lightweight defense record. It kind of reminds me of heavyweight, right? Like, once Stipe broke out of that, like, three-way tie of two title defenses, everyone's just like, okay, he's the heavyweight goat. Like, he's got the one stat that distinguishes himself. Both these guys were pretty good finishers, but you look at the way Islam is finishing all these guys. I know he's had a little more tooth and nail wars. Like, some people thought he lost the Volk fight. The first one, I didn't. I was there cage side. I thought he won that. But as you mentioned, the check mark in Khabib's favor is never losing those rounds, really. Never having a cut or a blemish like we've seen Islam have. So it's a very close one. I mean, unreal. These two are pupil and coach and all this stuff. And we're talking about them in the top two, and it's so close. But yeah, this was a really tough one. I guess I just give Islam that spot because not only do I think he obviously does have the record, but I think he's going to extend it probably here. So yeah, if this is competitive, you have Khabib at one. I don't know how much longer that's going to last regardless. So it's very close between these two.
Well, I'm curious now, Mike. If you have Islam as the number one lightweight champion of all time, do you now have Islam in that GOAT talk or that Mount Rushmore talk of the top 4 to 5 guys that have ever competed in MMA?
He's getting really close, man. Like, I think I would have to sit there and maybe mull over exactly the resumes, but you look at the things he has in his favor. I mean, the 15-fight winning streak, the second longest in UFC history on top of the title defense record. If he breaks Anderson Silva's record, I think you're definitely having those conversations, because to me, that's been one of the most like unbreakable records, right? I think the most unbreakable one is Demetrius Johnson's title defense record, because it's so hard to win that many title fights in a row, not change divisions, not whatever. But winning 16 fights in a row, man, in the UFC, you know this, like, to not slip on a banana peel, to not get poked in the eye or kicked in the groin and have a no contest, like to not have a weird judge's decision for 16 fights in a row. Like, so many things can happen in there, things that are out of your control, weird stuff that could lead to a loss or a no contest. To have that level of consistency is absolutely remarkable. So he's sitting at 15 straight wins. A lot of them are finishes. Now 5 of those are in title fights. He's getting pretty high up there in terms of like the all-time resumes. And if he adds a second belt in the second division, I think we're off to the races here as far as what could be possible for Islam's legacy.
Yeah, I think Islam's one went away for me to surpass Khabib Nurmagomedov. But I also, like, again, there's MMA math, there's numbers, there's title defenses. There's different ways of looking at this to argue it. But
if he had fought Armin instead of Moicano this past Saturday and, you know, won a dominant decision or finished him, would that have changed it for you?
It would have persuaded me slightly. I think so. I think it would have. Like I said, it was his body of work prior to that that had me on the edge about a 45 or twice, as I mentioned, handpicking Dustin, etc., etc. Also, like I said, I thought Dustin was more in his prime against Khabib, and you look at how Khabib didn't really have a blemish on his face after Dustin. And I know we're talking about one elbow, but I mean, he was, his Islam is scarred for life. He has a scar from the fourth, you know, he went 4 rounds, hard rounds, bleeding. And I thought Khabib handled Dustin much more dominantly. And then I look at these two guys and I say, what happens if they fought each other? Would Khabib win? Would Islam win? And that was kind of my deciding factor, really. I think even though Islam is the much better striker, I think Khabib is the more dominant grappler, and it's shown throughout his history and his resume and his career. And I think Khabib would win that fight. If those two guys fought in their prime, I think Khabib gets the takedowns. He does what he's always done. It's much harder. He has to work much harder, but eventually the chain wrestling would pay off. He would get the takedowns. He would stay out of harm's way, and I think Khabib would win. So Khabib remains number one on my list until one more fight, because if Islam has 5 title defenses compared to Khabib's 3, it's just we're in a different category now. We're talking about setting records right now, but right now for me, the 4 against the 3 title defenses of Khabib, it's still too close.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you said there could be the ultimate defining point. If they fought and Khabib and Islam have both said who have got the better of those like training sessions. Seems like historically it's been Khabib, but I guess you never really know. But going off that, if you want to pick him as your number one, no issues at all. Alan, before I let you go, let's just talk a little bit more about Islam. I'm curious, you know, everyone says he's like this big lightweight weight bully, right? But we saw the California Commission release the fight night weights. Yeah. I don't know if you saw that for Saturday, and he was lighter compared to Moicano, and I think lighter than Grant Dawson, who fought on the card at lightweight as well. So do you have any takeaways from these fight night weights that we get from California? I know it's very rare, but what did you think of that when you saw that Islam was the lighter guy?
First off, I love to see it. I love when they do disclose that, because now you have an idea when some guys, this one, Islam was not the bigger man. He was the bigger man. Like, just, you know, Dustin was telling me that he weighed a lot more than him when Dustin fought Islam. But to see that he was a smaller man in this matchup, and when he got on top, he wasn't budging. When he got on top in this fight against Moicano, there wasn't even really shrimping out. There wasn't even an escape plan, because when you feel a wet blanket on top of you and you go, this guy's a step ahead of me and he feels like a ton of bricks, there's not really any escape plan. And you see that with the dominance, the strong positional control. And that's why Islam and Khabib and all these guys, they're like, jiu-jitsu black belt. What does that mean? Islam has submitted, I think, 5 jiu-jitsu black belts during this run right now. Position comes first, and then they force a submission. That Darce that he goes to not even have to lock up the Darce. And a lot of times for our viewers, like, you get here, and what you want to do is you want to be here on the bicep, right? That's locked in. So to only have to go half the steps, you know, one, two, three, four, to only have to go to two, and that's his power move. That's his go-to move. That's the move that Demetrius Mighty Mouse Johnson said. He got me twice with it in training.
Yeah.
He gets everybody within training. He submitted Dustin Poirier. Dustin Poirier went to sleep on him. He submitted another black belt in Moicano. To your strongest move to be a move that you only have to, that you can eliminate half of the steps. Oh my God. And then he forces it. He forces that arm underneath his opponent's arm and around the neck. It's going to be tough to stop, because if he shucks you down and then forces his submission on anybody, even if you escape, now you got to deal with that brick wall that's on top of you again. So I think he's going to be champion for a while. The toughest test that the division has against him, I believe, is Islam. As much as I love Charles Oliveira, I just don't think his grappling is as strong as Islam's. I hope that he stays in the division, though. I hope that he stays in the division and sets records. We're talking about him going up. What's he going to do? He's not going to fight Bilal, so he's going to skip to 185. I don't want to see that. I'm sorry.
No, I wanted to close on that. I mean, we saw the fight night weight. Is that, like, ridiculous to you? I mean, we started talking about the middleweights here, so let's close it out with Islam saying that he thinks he could go to 185 and fight Dricus du Plessis and win, and says, UFC, send me the contract, I'll do it. I mean, first of all, I love, like, the confidence and all that type of stuff. It shows why he's as great as he is. But do you, like, take this seriously at all, or do you liken it to Kamaru Usman saying, I'll skip 185 and fight Jan Blachowicz at 205 for the title there?
No, I don't need to see it. I like to see guys at their weight do dominant things and set records. And that's when we talk about greatness. Look, do I take it seriously? Yeah, I take it seriously. I think he's actually feels that that's what he wants to do. But has he earned it? Yeah. Okay. He set the record for title defenses. Orman is the guy in my plea, my case, that's the guy that sets him apart from Khabib. That's the guy that sets the records. So I think that's the one guy in the division that, there's a question mark. Can you beat this guy? Can you meet a guy that's equivalent to you in the grappling? That would change things. But what I don't like about this is me and Dean Thomas were talking about this. Guys, champions like to go and fight in other weight classes. Yeah, they think double champ, it has a ring to it. But they also think, because I've got nothing to lose, I go and I fight a guy at 185. If I lose, so what? It's like, so I don't like this, so what? It puts a taste in your mouth. The same thing as like when Donald Cowboy Cerrone said, I'm coming back just because I want to end with 50 fights or whatever the number was. Where's the purpose in that? Now we're like, oh, we can't wait to see him come back. No, why? Just because he wants to make a number, a round number? Like, if it was like, I love fighting, this is in me, there's a rematch that I want to have, there's something that needs to be done, but not just fighting to fight. The same reason when Anthony Smith came back and he his last fight and he was going through that terrible heartbreak of losing someone, but he said, I just want to fight because I just want to punch somebody in the face and get these emotions out. Mm-hmm. Dana didn't love it, right? Because now you're just fighting and we're paying you a buttload of money and you don't really care what happens. Obviously, if Islam goes up to 185, he wants to win. But if he doesn't win, so what? I'm still the lightweight champion. You're not taking my belt. I still have the belt. So I've got nothing to lose. That's why I don't like these double champs, especially, look, it's one thing if he's going up to 170, but to go up two weight classes, three weight classes is unreasonable, and he's got nothing to lose. I need to have something at stake in these fights, and there's nothing at stake if he goes and loses and comes back down and defends his belt and puts he's putting the division on hold.
Yeah, great points there. I think it would be a crazy visual to see, but outside of that, you never know the risk. I mean, look at Alexander Volkanovski. He was the number one pound-for-pound fighter in the world. He goes up, loses to Islam, and now he's in a position where if you're like, if he loses the next fight, things get real scary for where he's at and how it looks for his legacy and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, these are the implications of the game, Alan, but I've taken enough of your time here today, man. This was a great conversation. I love our list. I love the diversity and everything. Definitely, I want to know the comments if you think my list was better or Alan's list was better. But Alan, definitely appreciate your time, man. I'll let you get on with your day, and I hope the trip out to Saudi Arabia is very good for you. Any parting words, or let the people know where they can follow your great work?
Yeah, no, I appreciate you having me on, man. You guys follow me, you know, it's at Alan Joban as always. But I'm glad we went through this, because I've never really thought about this list, and I've always had Khabib really lingering somewhere around on, like, when we talk about Mount Rushmore, like four or five people, he was at the end of my list, but he was on that greats. You know, I look at the greats and he was somewhere lingering because I didn't like the way that Habib stopped so early, right? That was the fault that he had, is he stopped when he was in his prime. Cause like you said, you don't know if any given night, man, you have a bad weight cut. You get out there and you just feel flat. Yeah. Somebody just has the energy of the crowd. You can't shake it. You slip. So many things could happen on any given night over the course of years of defending. And that's why John Jones is so great, because he's had on and off nights. He's faced adversity. He's faced champions. He's faced the next guy coming up in line. And that's why he stayed supreme and dominant. And that's why he's the GOAT. Habib went through a short span of it and then said, I'm out, which is, look, it's respectable, but it lowers you on my list because who knows what would have happened for the next couple of years. Islam has an opportunity here to right the wrong of what Habib did, to go and clean out a division. He's already broke the record. Now we can go and put that other record in the past and get 4, 5, 6, 7 title defenses. And it would be no question. He would be the lightweight GOAT and he would be on that Mount Rushmore. So that's why I just urge him to stay in his division and do something great. A double champ has a ring to it, but to be one of the greatest of all time, to me, surpasses a double champ.
Yep. For sure. The title defenses of, you know, Anderson Silva, of John Jones, of George St. Pierre, of Demetrius Johnson, those are arguably your four greatest fighters in UFC history, and that is for a reason. So great points there, Alan. I appreciate you being so thoughtful for this list and taking the time. We are definitely going to have you back on in the future now, but for now, I will let you think ahead to UFC Saudi Arabia, man. Safe travels out there. Going to take a quick break, and then I will be back to wrap things up. Thank you so much to Alan for his time and coming on. I thought that was a very, very fun discussion of the greatest lightweight champions in UFC history. We had some disparity on our list there. I was a little surprised, as was he. You could tell with our placement, but I think we obviously agreed on the top two, even though it was a slightly different order there. So I'm curious to know what you guys think, who had the better list and who was more on point. But before we get out of here for the week, as I tease off the top, a giveaway here on the Bonfire for the first time. And here it is, a boxing glove signed by the GOAT, Clarissa Shields, who is set to return to the ring for her boxing match on February 2nd. And her team sent this over saying, you should do a giveaway and give one of these to the people who support your podcast. So here we are. I want you guys to leave comments on this episode on whichever platform, and our great producer Kamikaze is going to pick what he thinks the best one, and the winner I will ship this glove out for. So if you are interested in this Clarissa Shields signed glove ahead of her boxing match coming up early next month, leave a great comment on the show and potentially you could have that shipped over to you. So we are evolving here on the Bonfire, some giveaways and potentially some other fun stuff like this coming up on the horizon. But for now, that does it for this week's episode. No UFC this weekend, but still some combat sports action. As I said to Alan Joban, BKFC Knuckle Mania going down Saturday in Philadelphia, headlined by Eddie Alvarez versus Jeremy Stevens. Earlier that day, the PFL Champion Series, first PFL event of the year, the Road to Dubai, headlined by a very intriguing lightweight title fight between Usman Nurmagomedov and Paul Hughes. Paul Hughes, confident as ever, he is going to pull off another upset after beating AJ McKee, and Usman Nurmagomedov, arguably the greatest fighter outside of the UFC right now. But we just saw his cousin, or his brother rather, Umar, lose his O and fail to come up with a belt at UFC 311 against Merab Dvalishvili. Is that going to elevate Usman's performance? Is it going to hinder him? Who knows, but it's going to be a very intriguing fight to watch. So definitely make sure to follow MMA Junkie for coverage of both those events. We'll have plenty of it. And until next week, back here on the Bonfire, appreciate everyone for listening.